Scripture this morning is Mark 13, verses 1 through 2. Mark 13, 1 through 2. And as he came out of the temple, one of his disciples said to him, "Look, teacher, what wonderful stones and what wonderful buildings." And Jesus said to him, "Do you see these great buildings? There will not be one left here, one stone upon another, that will not be thrown down."
If you have been around churches long enough, you have been witness at some point to one of the more disturbing scenes of church life, and that's someone leaving the worship that morning, the church's assembly, angry. If you go to church long enough, it's going to happen. Somebody gets mad. As a minister, you kind of see it from this end, and you see it more than maybe other people see it, but it does happen. I try to tell myself when it happens that it's not for me to worry about, because 9 times out of 10, if not 99 out of 100, it says more about the person storming out the back door than it does about the church they're leaving behind. More often than not, when people get mad at their church on a Sunday morning, it involves some kind of pettiness or selfishness, the very kind of thing we're trying to get rid of when we're doing our preaching from the gospel and worshiping together is the source of the frustration. Not to say it can't ever be a legitimate reason. That's kind of the point of the sermon today. But when we see it among us, I'm always a little bit skeptical when I say, "Oh, yeah, I'm sure you had a real good reason for getting mad and storming out the back door." But no matter what, whenever it happens, no matter how you justify it to yourself or no matter how you explain to yourself, "Oh, that person's just that way," it's always disconcerting. It's always uncomfortable when somebody storms out the back door in a mood. With that in mind, an observation that was pointed out to me about our text this morning of Mark, the 13th chapter, 1 and 2, is it's an example of Jesus leaving church angry, or the first century equivalent of it. Jesus has, in the 13th chapter of Mark, culminated almost an entire week in the temple. This is the last week of Jesus' life. He comes into town on a Sunday, and Sunday night in Mark's gospel, he stops in at the local temple there in Jerusalem, up on the hill, the beautiful, well-adorned temple that Herod had rebuilt and enlarged upon. It was a source of national pride. It was magnificent. Up until like the recent era, I don't know if you're aware of this, but until like very recently, the site of the temple that Herod built, I mean, he had to expand the Temple Mount to make his additions. It was until recently the largest man-made platform on the earth, right? It was the largest man-made hill anybody had bothered to try to make. The campus of the temple that Herod built, that he re-established, was something like 24 football fields in campus space, including porches and places for people, a big temple up here for the Jews, and then a little further up a fort for the Romans to look down on them and peer at them and keep them in line. It was a source of considerable pride, and Jesus walks in and begins a week of being unimpressed. The next day, not that night, now this is an interesting thing that only happens, I think, in Mark's gospel. In Mark's gospel, back a few chapters before our text, Jesus enters in on Sunday evening and kind of looks around and says, mm-hmm. And then he goes back and leaves. And then the next morning, he comes into the temple, and it's the scene that we remember, where Jesus gets angry and he's got his whip and we're overthrowing money changers and the whole business, right? This is an exciting scene. And he says, "You've made the house of prayer into a den of thieves." On that occasion, I'll say I think Jesus was picking a fight. I really do. He came in the night before, looked around, saw what was going on, went home, slept on it, came back, and made his point, right? This wasn't a knee-jerk reaction. In Mark, it makes it very clear he thought this through. He's making a point earlier in Mark when he cleanses the temple. But today's text comes from a little bit later in the story. This is later in the week, closer to the crucifixion. And Jesus has now been in and out of the temple a couple of days. And he has been watching the normal procedure of temple life. This account of this particular event is recorded at least three times in the gospel. We're going to look at Mark 13, 1 and 2, but it's also, for those of you that want to go home and study, in Matthew 24, 1 and 2, and in Luke 21, 5 and 6. And in all three accounts, the same five things seem to happen. Number one, Jesus rebukes the temple leadership. In the scene just preceding it, in Matthew 24, it's an entire chapter. Matthew 23 is a chapter-long rebuke of everything he saw. In the other accounts, it's a little shorter. In Mark, it's about four verses, maybe five. But in every account, it opens with Jesus openly rebuking the people who are running the temple. And then in the story, the same thing happens in all three accounts. Somebody, usually his disciples, point out the beauty of the temple. And you can kind of imagine, here is a person who's been in this temple, the source of national pride, day after day after day, and all he can see is what's wrong. And somebody says, oh, come on. Take a look. This is magnificent. There is not a place like this on the face of the earth. Especially for Jesus' disciples. They had been there a time or two before. But these are Galilean fishermen. Do you remember the first time you went to the big city? You country folk like me. First time you went to the big city and you saw the buildings and you just, eyes are big, right? When they go into Jerusalem and they see the temple, that's not the kind of building you walked into in Galilee. This wasn't your fisherman's hut. This was incredible. And they point and they say, isn't this magnificent? And in all three accounts, Jesus has essentially the same response. He is simply unimpressed. He looks at everything they point to and is not amused at all. He says something along the lines of, not one stone will be left upon another, which is the opposite of, wow, that's great. It'll burn is not the reaction you're going for when somebody's showing off how great something is. In all three accounts, afterwards, the disciples kind of duck their heads and follow him, and he leaves and he goes out to the Mount of Olives, which is just outside the temple, but kind of overlooking the city of Jerusalem. And when they get there in private, they take him aside, and they say, could you kind of clarify what you meant by that? And they want to know, what could you possibly mean by all that? And then what follows in all three accounts is a fairly complicated and confusing description of divine judgment. In Matthew's account, it's really neatly divided up. There's a prophecy of doom against the temple, and then a prophecy of doom and judgment against the whole world. In Mark's account, they're a little bit closer together. In Luke's account, they're practically on top of each other. So it's very difficult to sort out, what is Jesus talking about in this verse? Is he talking about the temple still, or is he talking about the planet? It's really not clear, which leads to a lot of Christian confusion, and it's not my sermon today to fix that, so sorry about you. You're going to have to keep working on that one on your own for at least another week. But what I'm interested in this story from the gospel, is the fact that Jesus is so deeply angry and disappointed by what he saw at the temple. Because this is the part that gets me, and this is what I want to point out today for us to reflect on. There is no indication in the text that anything unusually bad happened at the temple that day. Everyone in this room has had a Sunday morning where you went home thinking, well, that was lousy. Hopefully it's not today. But it all happens, right? At some point in your life, if you're a church-going person, at some point you leave, and whether you didn't like the songs, or the preacher went too long, or he stepped on your toes, or that prayer wasn't any good, or so-and-so sat next to you and they didn't smell good. I mean, whatever it is, we've all had a Sunday where you went home and said, well, that was a waste of an hour. It happens. In the life of faith, inevitably, I'm not saying it's a good thing, I'm just saying all of us have said, yeah, okay, that wasn't my favorite Sunday in the history of Sundays. And you can point back and say, here's the thing that happened that I was pretty well disgusted with. In Jesus' case, there's no indication that it was just a terrible day at the temple. These aren't the country amateurs running the temple. These are the temple professionals. This isn't a synagogue out in the middle of nowhere. This is the temple with the Hasmonean priests in their professional careers carrying out the work of the temple, and things were going along pretty well in a magnificently adorned temple. And Jesus comes out utterly unimpressed. What questions does that lead me to? Three that I want to think about today. Why isn't Jesus impressed? Everybody else there that day said, "Wow, this is wonderful." Jesus says, "Not so much." Why is that? And I want to know. Because question two, why is Jesus angry? He's not just unimpressed. Whether it's turning over the tables or just saying it's all going to fall, he is angry about what he sees. Which leads me toward the more daunting third question. How would Jesus react if he visited here on a Sunday morning? Because there is a temple offering what they believed was their best rendition of their worship to God. And the very being who should have been in awe of that reverence leaves unimpressed and unamused. That concerns me. Because while there are some Sundays where I leave here saying, "Well, that was all right," there are a lot more Sundays where I leave here saying, "That was good. I was glad I was there. I enjoyed that worship. I enjoyed offering that worship. Everybody's so nice. And I think it was good." That happens quite a lot. Does this mean that I could think we had a fantastic worship service in a wonderful church, in a comfortable building, and that God could say, "I'm unimpressed"? That is a disturbing thought to me. It disturbs me a little if one of you leaves angry. It chills me to the bone to think that God might leave angry. And that's the thought I want to consider this morning. Sounds fun, right? Let's take a look at the Mark text and ponder then what we're seeing. In Mark, the 12th chapter, just back up a few verses, and you get a peek at one of the things that seems to have deeply angered Jesus. He went to the temple, the source and place of worship of God, and instead of seeing selflessness, he saw selfishness. Read with me from Mark chapter 12, verses 38 through 44. "And in his teaching he said, 'Beware of the scribes, who like to walk around in long robes and like greetings in the marketplaces and have the best seats in the synagogues and the places of honor at feast, who devour widows' houses and for a pretense make long prayers. They will receive the greater condemnation.' And he sat down opposite the treasury and watched the people putting money into the offering box. Many rich people put in large sums, and a poor widow came and put in two small copper coins, which make a penny. And he called his disciples to him and said to them, 'Truly I say to you, this poor widow has put in more than all those who are contributing to the offering box, for they all contributed out of their abundance, but she out of her poverty has put in everything she had, all she had to live on.'" In Mark, those two stories are right next to each other on purpose, folks. Don't think for a moment that the Gospels line things up on accident. They put stories next to each other to help you understand the point of each. On the one hand, he's rebuking the scribes and Pharisees who are walking around the temple and in the outsides of the temple in their robes and looking, you know, well-to-do and enjoying themselves. And at the same time, devouring widows' houses. Now, how are they doing that? I mean, I'll have to tell you, I don't exactly know. Are they bankers and they're foreclosing? Maybe, but I don't know that that's the case. I know that if you hang around religion long enough, you'll see people who devour widows' houses. And a lot of times, they get the widows to do it voluntarily. They convince people who are in the deepest amount of need that they need to give what they have left so I can have what I think God wants me to have. I could preach a scathing sermon on that. I'll dodge it for a minute. But it makes me angry when I see it too. And you can see that sort of thing might be exactly what Jesus is talking about. I mean, think about this for a minute. And I'm not going to push this interpretation, but I just want you to think about it. What if the story that follows, the widow and her mites, isn't a story told to say all of you should be like this widow? What if instead Jesus is pointing out to these other people, you are wealthy, and yet somehow have convinced this woman she needs to put in her grocery money for you to continue? Magnificent temple, ornate and well-designed, the priest well-to-do and well-heeled, everybody's got money, and they kick in a little bit, but somehow we've convinced the widow, who needs to go home and feed herself, that we need your penny. We need your two mites. Jesus is impressed with her, don't get me wrong, but what if the larger point in context with the other rebuke is that how dare you take advantage of her and her poverty to get what you need out of this? When Jesus looked at the temple, he saw people devouring widows. Folks, the religion of the people in the temple was not about God. It was about what they could get out of it. A good description might be the words of Paul in Philippians 3 and verse 19. Their end is destruction. Their God is their belly. And they glory in their shame with mind set on earthly things. There was a God in that temple, but it was not the God of heaven who honors widows and protects the orphan. It was the God of the belly. It was the God of self. The God who used the temple as a means to get what they wanted out of it. And that makes Jesus angry. Jesus left church angry that day because he went to church but found the wrong God there. It wasn't Baal or Asherah, it was the worshipers themselves who were receiving the praise and honor in that temple rather than the God of heaven. And Jesus is having none of it. Another thought that comes to mind, mentioned in the same passage, is the pretension of the worshipers. It mentions that while they're on the one hand scandalously taking advantage of the people around them, with the other hand, they're offering up what looks like spectacular worship, right? Now let me just make a pause here and comment because I don't want this to be misunderstood. He mentions in verse 40, for a pretense make long prayers. I don't believe Jesus is saying you should never have a long prayer, okay? How long should a prayer be? A prayer, like a sermon, should go until it's done. Okay? I don't believe worship comes with a clock. I know, we put one back there. We're trying the best we can. But the fact is, in Scripture, worship takes however long it takes. And so when you read the Psalms, there's a psalm that's two verses long. And there's a psalm two chapters later that has 22 eight-verse stanzas. I want Edwin to lead that one next week. I want the 22-verse song on Sunday morning, right? Which one is appropriate length? Whichever one you need that day. Folks, there's some days when I need a two-verse prayer. And there are some days when I need every word I've got and some I don't know yet to say what needs to be said. There isn't a problem with long prayers or short prayers or in-between prayers. Christ's complaint is that they're doing it out of pretentiousness. That they think they will look more religious the more they say. That it's not that they have so much to say to God that they have to keep going. Rather, it's that they want to be seen as people who have so much to say to God and do it well. And Christ says that's not what worship is supposed to look like. The people in the temple sounded religious. To go a step further, the people in the temple liked to sound religious. They liked the honor that it brings them. But the people in the temple did not practice a pure religion. How do we know it's pretentious? Well, here's a hint. James chapter 1 tells us that pure religion, undefiled before God and the Father, is this: to visit the widows and the orphans in their affliction and to keep yourself unspotted from the world. What were these folks doing? Offering magnificent prayers while devouring widows. Jesus says, I know your prayers are things that you don't mean because I see what else you're doing. And it doesn't matter how loudly you say it or how magnificently you offer up your prayer. If your life designates you as a person who does not recognize the Godship of God, of his rulership over this world and how you treat his creatures, then no amount of words can fill the place of what should have been in your heart in life. It sounded religious, and they loved how religious it sounded. But it was a pretense. I think the second reason I can say that Jesus left church angry that day is because he went to church but found no worshipers there. Somebody took attendance that morning. How do I know that? Because you can't have a church without somebody taking attendance. That's just the way it works. Somebody, there was a guy at the gate of the temple with a card checking people off. I have no doubt about it in my mind. I'm sure it happened that way. Maybe it was an iPad. I don't know. Something happened. There were people in the building. It wasn't an empty room. But when Jesus looked around, he says, I don't see any worshipers here. He sees one, a widow lady, giving away her grocery money, which he sees as itself a scandal all its own. But he looks around and he sees selfish people. They are there because of how being there makes them feel. Do you understand that? They like the feeling. And I'm not even, let me just pause here. I'm not even saying they were there to be entertained. Sometimes the preacher gets up and he says, well, you don't go to worship, be entertained. Okay, that's fine. That's a good point. I'll preach that sermon another day. That's not who these people are. They are there because of the feeling of religiosity, of piousness that they got. Being at the temple and wearing the temple clothes and going through the motions gave them a feeling of satisfaction and superiority over everybody else that they saw. And they thrived on it. When they offered the long prayer, they could get done and say, yeah, I did pretty good at that. That was a prayer, folks. Oh, Ben, that was such a prayer. Jesus says, that's not worship. That is something that looks like worship that is made to satisfy you. And that's not what worship is. Does that unnerve you? The idea that you could have a house of prayer, you could have a place of worship that could be full to the brim in every seat with people that were there for the full duration, and every one of them could leave that morning and say, that was a fine worship service. And Jesus could look around and say, I didn't see any worship. And I didn't see any worshipers. Because of what was going on in the person's heart. Jesus loves to point this out. There's another story Jesus tells. It's a parable this time. He says, two men went up to the temple to pray. One is a pious man. And he prays a prayer that is magnificently religious. He extols the goodness of his faith and the majesty of his fasts and his offerings to God. There's another man who is a publican who won't even lift his eyes towards heaven. And his prayer, all of two verses, I suppose, said, God have mercy on me, a sinner. The point of that sermon, that little parable that Jesus tells, is not even about how to pray, although it is. The bigger point is at the end when Jesus said, one man went down to his house justified and the other didn't. Do you understand? Two men went to the temple to pray. Only one of them did. Two men went to the temple to pray. Both of them thought they had been religious that day. Only one of them ever spoke anything to God. The scary thing about that parable and about this story is that the people leaving temple that day thought they had done just fine. Why does that frighten me? Because on Sunday morning I leave those doors and I feel like we did okay. And Jesus says, I'm unimpressed. Because you ultimately are not the judge of your worship. And your satisfaction is not as in fruit. It is the extolling of the majesty of the God of heaven that counts. And if we haven't done that, it really doesn't matter what we think about it. Which brings me to my third point. This, I'll cheat a little and skip out of Mark, because I like the way Matthew words it. At the end of the series of rebukes in the book of Matthew, chapter 23, and right before he said, they say, hey, look at the temple, and he says, yeah, it'll burn, he says these ominous words about the temple. See, your house is left to you desolate. Two things that ought to disturb us about that. One, the word desolate means empty. Not just like temporarily empty, like permanently empty. This church building is empty on Monday morning. Like if you come into the auditorium, there's not people sitting around waiting for you to get there. Okay, Monday morning, 9 a.m., nobody in this room. But it's not desolate. Because there's people coming back, right? It just happens to be empty when you walked in. Desolate is empty and it's not getting filled again. Desolate is abandoned. So the first thing Jesus points out here that I want to mention is he says, this temple is abandoned. The second thing is, he says it in the present tense. Now, in the next chapter, he's going to prophesy the doom of that same temple to come someday. But before he prophesies its doom, he starts by saying it is already abandoned. Do you understand how absurd that is? Because the temple was full. There were people all over the place. They just talked to Jesus. He just complained about them. I know there were people there. He says this temple is empty. He's not talking about the people. Someone was missing in that temple that was supposed to be there. Let me give you a hint of who it might be. This is a quotation, a paraphrase perhaps, but in a quotation from the book of Jeremiah. Jeremiah in 586 BC is witnessing Nebuchadnezzar come in with his Babylonian army, sack the city of Jerusalem, and burn the temple. And God says to Jeremiah, "Your house is desolate." Do you understand the eeriness of that statement? Jeremiah is being told that temple is burning because God isn't there. Jesus looks not at a burning temple, at a beautiful temple, a magnificent temple, and says the same thing God said about it when it was on fire. That is a scary statement. Your house is already desolate. Expanded, remodeled, beautiful, empty. A lot of people were in church that morning, but God wasn't one of them. He hadn't been invited. He was not honored. He was not glorified. It was an empty house. I think Jesus left church angry that morning because he went to church, but he didn't find God there in God's own house. What do we do with material like this, and why would I preach it in this way, and why would we care? I stumbled across an old commentary from a commentator now passed on. He was actually writing about Luke's account of this text. His name was Albert Schweitzer, not a guy I quote very often, but he had something to say about this text that I found very interesting and compelling. He said, "But when the living God forsakes the house, the walls of the magnificent temples and churches may remain standing, but all the religious activity and all the theological expertise cannot conceal the fact that they are empty, deserted by all good spirits, and that it is only a question of time until they fall to ruin. They will be visited only by tourists with an interest in art history, whose guides repeat the terrifying echo, 'This is the temple of Yahweh.'" What is Schweitzer trying to say about the text? He says the scary thing about this is that the temple was empty and nobody knew it. And once God leaves the house, there is nothing but one alternative for what happens next. Our culture has attempted to build many godless temples. We have said we want to run our homes and our nations and our businesses without the living God in it. And churches have followed suit. We have constructed mighty houses without a God. There is only one end of that story. And I'm not even speaking hypothetically, because it's already happened. I want to read a little paragraph. If you'll permit me a reading, and unless you leave church angry, you can't stop me, right? If you'll permit me a little reading from a book by a lady named Barbara Brown Taylor, who is describing in her chapter a trip she took to a very old church in Turkey. There's the Turkey reference for my Thanksgiving sermon. Everybody get that? She went to the country of Turkey and was traveling among the wilderness. And I wanted to read this little description of what she saw there. She says, "Two summers ago, I traveled to northeastern Turkey for a walk in the Kakhar Mountains, a stretch of land between the Black and Caspian Seas where the kingdom of Georgia flourished between the 11th and 12th centuries. During its brief ascendance in this part of the world, Georgia was a kind of Camelot, a Christian kingdom in which strong and benevolent rulers carved a culture out of the wilderness and defended it from its enemies. They imported Byzantine artists from Constantinople to adorn their public buildings and built an economy that prospered all their subjects. 200 years later, it was gone, torn to pieces by neighboring tribes. Now it is a wilderness again, although a beautiful one. a kingdom of mountains, tall pines, and rushing streams, populated only by a handful of people who found flat places to farm. One afternoon in the middle of nowhere, a guide led a group of trekkers up a dirt road toward a small settlement hidden behind some trees. We turned a bend, and the outline of a ruined cathedral appeared. A huge gray stone church with a central dome that dominated the countryside. Grass grew between what was left of the roof tiles, and the facade was crumbling. But even in the shambles, it spoke to us. The whole group fell silent before it, looking around for permission to enter. But no permission was necessary. It was a hull, a shell. No living thing remained inside, and we were free to explore. Arriving at the main portal, I stepped through and was swallowed up by the sheer size of the space inside. Very little of the roof had survived, but the massive walls still held plaster frescoes and the shadows of biblical scenes on them. There were lambs of God carved on the stone capitals and medieval saints with their faces chipped away. Some of the best stones had been plundered for other purposes, but those that remained testified to the care and expense that had been lavished on this house of God. Poking around, I found evidence of campfires in one side of the chapel. The other had been turned into a garbage dump where rats prowled for scraps. From the transept, I heard the sound of children and returned to find them playing soccer in the green lawn that covered the floor of the central nave, while a couple of sheep grazed under the apse. In the dome just above, it was still possible to see one outstretched arm of Jesus who had presided over the Eucharist. The rest of him had flaked away. Sitting down under what was left of his embrace, I surveyed the ruins of his church. It is one thing to talk about post-Christian era, and quite another to walk around inside of it. Christianity died in Turkey. The land that gave birth to Paul, and that he found so fertile for the sowing of his gospel, the land of Ephesus, of Galatia, Colossae, and Nicaea. The last Arminian baptisms were recorded as late as the 1890s, but today the Christian population of Turkey is less than 1% of the total. Churches that were the jewels of Byzantine Christendom have been stripped of their altars, founts, and crosses. Many have been turned into mosques, while others are open to tourists as museums, and still others have been left simply to rot. Looking around the magnificent Georgian cathedral that had been abandoned for almost 1,000 years, I imagined my own church in its place. The beautiful wooden rafters rotted out and the ceiling collapsed, shards of stained glass hanging from the window panes, the carved stone altar removed to some museum, along with a processional cross, the vestiges of an ancient faith no longer practiced in the land. Such a thing is not impossible. That is what I learned in that ruin on the hillside. God has given us good news in human form and has even given us the grace to proclaim it. But part of our terrible freedom is the freedom to lose our voices, to forget where we are going and why. And while that knowledge does not yet strike me as prophetic, it does keep me from taking both my own ministry and the ministry of the whole church for granted. If we do not attend to God's presence in our midst and bring all our best gifts to serving that presence in the world, we may find ourselves selling tickets to a museum. Christianity is a beautiful kingdom, and I don't believe in the grand scheme of things that Christianity will fail. But that doesn't mean it has to flourish here. That does not mean that any church you walk into cannot become an empty shell. The temple that sat on that hilltop in Jerusalem was a marvel of beauty and engineering. The priests there were talented, gifted, knowledgeable, and professional. The people that came there looked as religious as any person you'd ever want to meet. But God was not in that temple and hadn't been for some time. The question of our church is whether we recognize the God of heaven in it, whether we are worshipers of him or of comfort, and whether we have invited him into our midst. If not, there is nothing but desolation that's possible, no matter how magnificent and impressed we are by what we do on a Sunday morning. That's a frightening set of thoughts, and it's supposed to be. They looked at Jesus and said, "Behold the temple stones." And he simply said, "Not one will be left upon another." That is not the future I want for any church, and certainly not for the Glenpool Church of Christ. The way to make sure that certain future is different than that is each and every time we come together to empty ourselves of ourselves and turn our attention to heaven and make sure he comes here. If you've not turned to Christ, then your life, like a temple, has been left empty of its God. Every human life is made to be filled with the living God. And every life without him is a shell. Invite the living God into your life in faith and in repentance. Confessing the name of Jesus Christ, being baptized to begin a new walk as his temple and as his people. We're going to stand and sing a word of encouragement. If you need any assistance, won't you come?